Our sun is headed into solar maximum, the period of greatest activity in its solar cycle. My name is Troy Klein, and welcome to the new podcast series called Space Weather Living History. During this series, you'll hear directly from the people who for years have been studying the evolution of space weather, how we make observations, and our capabilities to predict space weather events. Now, every 11 years on average, our sun reaches a peak period of activity called solar maximum. That's followed a few years later by a period of quiet called solar minimum. During solar maximum, there are many sunspots, solar flares, and coronal mass ejections, all of which can affect communications and technology here on Earth. Now, the energy from those solar blasts can disrupt radio communications, upset electrical power systems, damage satellites and change their orbits, cause navigational equipment to make mistakes, and even endanger astronauts walking in space. The effects from these solar storms can be far-reaching. In fact, they can have impacts throughout our entire solar system. These conditions are what we refer to as space weather. Sound exciting? Let's get right to the next interview.
Okay, my name is John Phillips. I was a NASA astronaut from 1996 to 2011. I had three space flights. Before that, long before, I was a Navy pilot. Then I went to grad school at UCLA, got a PhD in space plasma physics, and then worked 9 years at Los Alamos National Lab in New Mexico, working on spacecraft instrumentation and observations from a variety of spacecraft. My primary research interests were the sun and the solar wind, which is a charged gas, ionized gas that flows continuously but variably out from the sun, and which envelops the Earth and is the main driving, or one of the main driving factors in what we call space weather.
And what is it that you believe that influenced you most to actually be drawn to this area? What is it that you like so much about it that it became such a primary focus?
You know, actually, it was kind of serendipity. I picked my program at UCLA out of a catalog. This was before the internet, and you looked up university information in a catalog. And I went to the San Diego Public Library one day. I was in the Navy in San Diego and read this description of a program called space physics, and I didn't exactly know what it was. And I applied for it and got accepted. So I went to UCLA without really knowing what I was getting myself into. My interests really were more in remote sensing of the Earth, but as it turned out, I liked it once I started studying it, space physics that is, which had to do basically with plasmas and electric and magnetic fields and the various regimes that are in around the sun and planets and Earth and the moon. And I just found it really interesting. I like my physics on a big scale, kilometers, not nanometers. And I thought it was very interesting, and all the courses that I took were good. And then I got a job at Los Alamos National Lab and kept working in that field. We've been studying space physics since the International Geophysical Year in 1957-58. And so I wasn't in on the ground floor, but I started in that business in the 1980s. But nevertheless, I got involved in some fairly groundbreaking spacecraft missions, particularly the Ulysses mission over the poles of the sun. Whether or not it helped me get to start a career as an astronaut, I will probably never know. The fact that I was working on NASA-based programs probably worked in my favor when I applied to be an astronaut. But nevertheless, it took me a long time. I took the scenic route to the launch pad. I put in my first application in 1976 and finally got hired in 1996. The biggest turning point for me was the launch and the flight of the spacecraft Ulysses. Ulysses was actually a European spacecraft launched on the U.S. space shuttle and containing instruments from both the United States and Europe, launched in 1990, and first went out to Jupiter and went over the poles and then used the gravity deflection to turn south and then went over the poles and continued operating basically for about nearly 20 years. And I went over the poles of the sun, was on its third lap over the poles of the sun when they finally turned it off. And I was fortunate enough to be in on the launch and initial data return from that mission. And eventually, when the original principal investigator of our instruments retired, I became the principal investigator. I didn't help build the instruments. I came in a little later. But what was very nice about it was every time I would get a new week's worth of data, we would get data a week at a time. And I would see observations that no one had ever seen before, in a place where no one had ever taken measurements before. And that was very exciting. It's a form of exploration that even though I'm just sitting in my office looking at new results, for me it was every bit as exciting as something where I was doing it physically, like going to the South Pole or going to space. What was unique about Ulysses was that it went over the poles of the sun. So we were able to measure not only the solar wind, but energetic particles and electromagnetic fields with a solar origin, basically in the complete environment surrounding the sun, not real close, but not just from the vantage point of Earth, which is where every other spacecraft had measured these phenomena. So we were able to kind of make a global map of how the sun produces the plasma and electromagnetic field environment that we are enveloped in. We were able to produce this global map that helped us understand the entire process.
And do you think in the future, as we venture further into space, hopefully do additional exploration, can you imagine that the type of research and data that we can get from those remote regions far away from Earth, that the type of impact that might have on our understanding of the solar system and space weather? I mean, I can imagine that there are questions out there that remain unanswered that students today and people who are listening to this will be able to be part of one day.
Absolutely. As every new spacecraft or every new observatory produces observations that are unique, whether it's because the spacecraft's in a different place or because it has a better instrument than the last spacecraft. And there are still major questions about the sun. I mean, for example, one of the real fundamental questions about space weather is, how does a solar corona, that's a region distant from the surface of the sun, how does it get heated? Because it's actually much hotter than the surface of the sun. So it would be like if you put a pan of cold water on a barely warm hot plate, and then the water started boiling. It doesn't make any sense from a thermodynamic standpoint. So you have to understand it from a standpoint of conversion of electromagnetic energy. And as every time we launch a new solar observatory or a new spacecraft into the inner solar system, we learn more and more about that really fundamental process.
Now, earlier you also talked about your experience in space as an astronaut. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Because you mentioned earlier that, you know, you were there for quite a prolonged period of time at one point, so your dosage rates would have been high. Can you walk us through some of your experience?
Sure. Well, my second space flight, my second of three, was in 2005. We launched and landed on a Russian Soyuz spacecraft. And there were only two of us, myself and a Russian fellow, and we were aboard the International Space Station for 6 months. Now, this was, to put it in the context of space weather, we were during the declining part of the sunspot cycle, almost at sunspot minimum. Sunspot activity was very, very low. And this is a period under which you don't get much radiation from impulsive solar events, but your background radiation from cosmic rays is actually high. And in 6 months in space, I didn't worry about space weather at all. I did, in fact, have a place on the space station where I could take shelter, where it was lined with polyethylene bricks. But we never had to do that. I did have a personal dosimeter, and there was also sort of a spacecraft-wide dosimeter with an alarm capability that was installed aboard the ISS. It never alarmed while we were on board. But after I got back in October 2005, I found out my radiation dose. And it turned out that in 6 months, I had absorbed a radiation dose of 8 rems. Rem is a Rankin equivalent band. 8 rems. Now, compare this with the OSHA dose of 5 rems per year for a person who, say, works in a nuclear power plant or works in some sort of radiation environment. I had 8 rems. The OSHA limit was 5 rems. So if I had been a nuclear plant worker, they would have had to send me home. But The natural limit, in fact, is considerably higher than the OSHA limit. It's 50 RIMS per year, plus they have an additional lifetime limit based on enhanced cancer risk. So I was over the OSHA limit in 6 months, but well under the NASA limit. And I found that out after I got back. But it is what it is. I can't worry about it too much. And it's also interesting that in my 15-year career as an astronaut, about half of my radiation dose came from spaceflight. The other half came from medical procedures and experiments.
Wow.
Yeah. A couple other aspects of space weather when I was in space was looking at the aurora, for one thing. And because I was personally interested in space weather, much more so than typical astronauts, or much more, every astronaut has their own interests, and most of them are not space physicists. I am, and so I was interested in the subject. So I had mission control every day when I was in space send me up the NOAA space weather report for that day. And so I was kind of aware of what was going on in terms of solar flares and sunspots, and there wasn't much of that during our time. And I was particularly interested in it because it would help me pick out times to look at the aurora borealis and aurora australis, or the northern and southern lights. Now, we were in space in northern hemisphere summer, so it was hard to see the northern lights. It was just too bright in the northern hemisphere. So most of the time what we would see was the aurora australis or southern lights, typically down around Tasmania or New Zealand. And we took some pictures, and we got to look at it a lot. And in the International Space Station, you're generally going over or sometimes through the aurora.
No
kidding. It was really, really spectacular.
So as you're traveling through your perspective, you're literally, as you look out your viewing window or port, you're able to actually see the aurora just all around you?
Yes, you can, occasionally. More often than not, we're above it, but sometimes we're sort of in it. And and once you're in it, it appears very, very diffuse. The lights are not very bright. Whereas from a distance, you can see structure. Once you get really close to it, what you're seeing is sort of a vague feeling that you're going through areas that are slightly illuminated in either blue or green. But we would see that quite often. And my crewmate, Sergei Krikalov, who was a very good photographer, took a lot of very nice pictures of the aurora australis, which is hard to do with a handheld camera because you need like a 2-second exposure to get a good image, and you're just holding the camera with your hand. Mm. And after getting some pictures that were not so good, I finally gave up and just said, I'm just going to enjoy this. I'm just going to watch it go by and not spoil the experience by trying to get a picture.
Now, I have seen some footage of the aurora australis from on YouTube in different places and through some NASA videos that have been released. Those were, I think, taken from the space station. Were you part of that, some of the release of some of the video footage in any way?
No, I wasn't. And I think I was on the station in 2005, mm-hmm. and those images were taken a little bit later when they had, one, better video cameras on board, and two, better windows. It would have been very difficult for us to have taken that kind of image. But I've watched them, and they can be really spectacular as you see the cities go by and occasional thunderstorms flashing, and then in the background you can see a faint aurora. I think they're really spectacular.
You also mentioned something about various things that you saw and witnessed while you were in space, one being clearly the aurora. What were some of the other things that you noticed and witnessed while you were there?
Well, the other things that I witnessed while I was there that involved space weather were primarily noctilucent clouds. Noctilucent means basically glow at night. And these are very thin, very high altitude clouds that mostly appear over the polar areas. And I can actually look at the spacecraft, the International Space Station doesn't go over the poles. But we've got a couple windows that look out on the horizon. So when we're near our peak northern and southern latitude, which is 51.6 degrees, we can look out one of those windows and see further toward the poles. And quite often I would see these noctilucent clouds, which are extremely high altitude clouds, that are part of the space, sort of the lowest altitude part of space weather, if you will. And I found them kind of interesting because I'd never seen it from the ground. And let me tell you one other experience I had, which involves yet another part of space weather, and this has to do with ozone. As you probably know, ozone in the upper atmosphere screens out much of the ultraviolet radiation that would otherwise hit Earth. And all the windows on the International Space Station are coated with an ultraviolet protective layer, except one particular window on the Russian segment. And most of the time, we were flying with that window facing Earth, not facing the sun, so I wasn't worried about ultraviolet light. And I got a little complacent. And then one day, I opened the shutter on this big window in the Russian segment, not realizing that the spacecraft had maneuvered, and that window was actually facing somewhat toward the sun. And I opened the shutter, and I got a big blast of sunlight on one side of my face. And I closed the shutter, and I estimate that I had sunlight on my face for about 4 seconds. And the next day, half of my face was red. So I got sunburned in 4 seconds by opening the shutter on this window that didn't have an ultraviolet coating. And I'd never been very much any kind of an expert on atmospheric chemistry or the way the ozone layer works, but I had a computer-based encyclopedia on board, so I looked it up that night, and it turned out that that the ozone layer screens out something like all but one part in several thousands of the flux of ultraviolet light in certain wavelengths onto the Earth. So my 4 seconds of exposure was like several, perhaps like 4 hours on the surface of the Earth. Yeah, there are natural objects in space in orbit, similar to the space station orbit. And then there are man-made objects from spacecraft launches and from collisions of spacecraft and deliberate shoot-downs of spacecraft, which have been done by China and by the United States. And actually, I was in space a little before those events. But there was still natural and man-made debris in space, and it's tracked basically by the U.S. Air Force, who sends out alerts when we're in danger of hitting a piece of debris. And NASA evaluates it and then decides, what are the odds that we're gonna strike this piece of debris? And if the odds go above a certain threshold, then they maneuver the spacecraft. Now, during my 6-month flight, we maneuvered the International Space Station one time for debris avoidance. And it's done very, very gently. The crew hardly even notices it. Small rocket engines are fired by command from the ground. And if they hadn't have told us we were going to maneuver, Sergey and I, my crewmate and I, probably wouldn't have even known it because it's a very gentle acceleration. But we changed orbits once in 6 months. By the way, phase two of this, what the crew does in response to a debris alert, is that they can go to their Russian Soyuz capsule, which is basically their lifeboat, and sort of hunker down there and wait for the debris to pass. We never had to do that. In fact, I think it's only been done once or twice in the whole life of the space station. But we did maneuver one time.
Now, out of all of the experiences that you had in particularly in space, the launch, your stay in space for an extraordinary amount of time, and then the return, reentry, and all of that, what do you think was the most either exciting or part of it that made your, maybe the most memorable part or part that made your heart nearly pound out of your chest? What would that be? What part of your experience?
For me, the most exciting part was landing in a Russian Soyuz capsule. This is very different from landing in a shuttle. In a shuttle, you only pull about 1.5 G's, and you end up rolling out on a runway. In landing on a Russian Soyuz capsule, you parachute in the grassland of Kazakhstan. You pull something like 5 G's on the way in, and parts of it are pretty intense, like in particular when the parachute first opens. I don't know exactly what it looks like from outside. I've never seen film of it, but what it feels like from inside. And remember that I've been in zero G. I've been weightless. I'm weightless for 6 months, so my body's used to weightlessness. And suddenly the forces have come on. But after we get through the upper part of the atmosphere and the spacecraft slows a bit, then a parachute opens. And when the parachute opens, it feels like you're spinning down a drain. That's what it feels like for about 3 or 4 seconds. If I hadn't been warned about it, if I didn't know it was a pretty violent few seconds, it would have been really scary. But my vision blacked out, and I felt like I was spinning down a drain for a few seconds.
And Chris, then, so was it spinning actually, or was it just a sensation?
No, actually, I don't think so. As I mentioned, I've never seen video of this event. I don't know what it looks like from outside, and I don't think anyone has ever taken video of it. But from inside, it feels like you're spinning down a drain. Mm-hmm. I think what it really is the spacecraft is just shaking really violently, and because your body's sensors are used to being weightless and haven't had to work very hard for 6 months, it confuses your body's attitude receptors. Sure. One other little event that happened when I was up there. Can I mention two other little events?
Sure.
First off, I got word that there was going to be a solar eclipse. And I asked the people on the ground to send me up information about the solar eclipse while I was up there. And it turned out we were going to fly through the shadow of the moon. And,
which eclipse was this?
And everything. Yeah. And as it turned out, we flew through the shadow of the moon while we were over the Indian Ocean. And I thought it was going to be very, very dramatic, like it's suddenly going to go from bright to dark. And actually, it was rather subdued. I could barely tell that we were in the shadow of the moon. We didn't go from, bright sky to dark. Well, the sky is always black in space, but we didn't go from bright sunlight to darkness. We went from bright sunlight to slightly less bright sunlight. So, but we did fly through at least a piece of the solar eclipse of the shadow of the moon. And then one other thing that happened while I was up there was there was a comet, and I wish I could remember the name of the comet, but I can't. It was predicted to impact Jupiter. And so I managed to find a place on the spacecraft where I could see Jupiter. And I positioned myself right when the comet impact was going to happen. And just in case something really spectacular happened, like a big explosion on Jupiter. But nope, Jupiter is a very big planet. Comet's not very big. Comet crashed into Jupiter and I didn't see a thing.
I hope you enjoyed the Space Weather Living History podcast brought to you by NASA's Sun Earth Days program. You can learn more about the Space Weather Living History Project on our website at sunearthday.nasa.gov. And don't forget to join our growing community of Facebook and Twitter fans for the latest information and facts about the new Sun Earth Day themes. For all other details about these programs, including information about our past Sun Earth Day's themes, be sure to visit our website at sunearthday.nasa.gov.
This is Troy Klein signing off.